tuned in to the First Few Moments podcast, a production of EMS Radio. The First Few Moments podcast is the most up-to-date source for responder best practice discussions and incident review. Join industry leaders and seasoned providers at firstfewmoments.com. You can talk to us through Twitter at First Few Moments, email us at podcast@firstfewmoments.com, or call us at 716-245-5FFM. Hello and welcome everybody to the First Few Moments podcast, the bi-weekly. Well, usually it's bi-weekly, but this week we have actually gone ahead and have a special edition. We have a special guest today. We take the concepts of safety management, triage, and care for motor vehicle crashes and kind of look at how they differ around the country. And, you know, we've talked with Wilma up in Fairbanks. We've talked with Natalie down in Louisiana and people from around the country. But there is a gentleman that I've been kind of wondering about how they do things over there across the pond in the green jumpsuits. Mr. Mark Glencourse. Mark, how are you today?
I'm very well, thank you. Thank you very much for having me on. I'm looking forward to having this chat, seeing how we differ.
Oh, Mark, I've been looking forward to this. For those people who don't know you, could you give a little background of yourself?
I'm a paramedic team leader in the UK in the northeast of England. Work is it's purely NHS ambulance service. There's none of this fire-based EMS or anything over here. Paramedic background of nursing since 1992, and then I joined the ambulance service in 2000. Was also a blogger for quite some, well, the last 18 months or so at medic999.com. There is some news coming about that soon, when I'll let everyone know when that happens. But that's about it, really. I've been involved in social media and across the Atlantic quite a lot with the Chronicles of EMS team. And I've got to know a lot of you guys very well over the last year. And it's just this wonderful thing that we have where we can share our experiences and learn from each other, which is what I'm looking forward to doing specifically for RTCs, we call them, over this side.
That's great. You know, I think this will be some interesting information. So, Mark, glad to have you on today.
Thank you.
Kind of from across the pond, was under the Queen's influence there for a while, was himself, Mr. Steve Murphy. Steve, how are you today?
I'm good, Kyle. Thanks for having me on again.
I remember going up there and doing some training in terms of legal aspects. And down here in the state, it's the state versus you in criminal law. And I always want to go up to Canada because I always thought it was kind of cool to be the Queen or the Crown versus you on that. I always found that kind of neat. Next with us is Medic SBK, Mr. Scott Keir. Why do I keep wanting to add an R to your name?
No problem. How you doing, Kyle?
Good, Scott. How are you today?
I am well. It's good to be back on.
Out of Massachusetts there.
Yes, sir. And Mark, on behalf of everybody up in Massachusetts, I just want to say sorry about that whole tea party thing.
It's quite all right. We'll let you have that one.
Great. And coming from down south there, Ms. Paramedic herself, Natalie Quibido. Natalie?
Hello.
How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Good. Are the hurricanes going to miss you?
I think so. I was checking the forecast just a second ago, and they look like they're going to swing into the Atlantic and miss us.
That's a good thing.
That's a great thing.
That's a great thing. And I believe sitting next to you is Mr. Jeremiah Bush.
Hey, Kyle. Thanks for having me on again.
Hey, guys. I'm glad to have you on. How's the training going?
It's going well. I'm halfway finished. So,
have they been torturing you and doing everything they can do to a new paramedic possible?
Not really. I kind of feel like I've been torturing them more so.
Sometimes.
But no, it's good. It's going quite well, actually.
Well, that's great. Glad to have all of you on here. Anyways, so Mark, you're going to be kind of our star today because I really want to find out some things. And, Steve, even from the Canadian, version of things, we can get some ideas. I know things are a little bit different up there. But in terms of safety, I think that's something that's been lacking here in the States for quite a while, especially on the EMS side. I think the fire's gotten a little bit better with it, but I think it's something that we're kind of missing here on EMS. Here in the States, when I look over and just the gear that you guys wear, it's much more high visibility. What have you noticed?
Just the experience that I had when I came over to San Francisco and worked with Justin, the Happy Medic, you know, there was various things that we noticed. And certainly when he came over and worked with me, he made some interesting comments, especially about RTCs, and one that we had on a significant motorway going through my area, where the one thing I think we miss a lot of the times is because we're not fire-based EMS, when we respond to an RTC, very often we're the only ones who get there first, you know, and we'll decide who needs to come and back us up. So at the very first point, there's just me and my crewmate. If I'm on an ambulance or if I'm on the rapid response car, there's just me. So we have to make best use of whatever we've got. In that case, it's my car with my blue flashing lights and all the high visibility Battenberg colouring on the sides of the car and the ambulances, and also our high vis jackets, which a lot of the firefighters in San Francisco found very amusing. They are very bright, but they do serve a purpose. But we don't have the sheer amount of numbers on scene, which what I've seen in the States happens. You know, if you have a fire-based model responding, there's a lot of bodies and there's a lot of vehicles on the scene to help protect you on the scene. A lot of the times it's just me parking my car a short distance away from the collision and blocking the road and just leaving it and hoping for the best till someone else comes. Hopefully the police will be on the way. The fire brigade don't automatically respond. It's only if there's reports of persons trapped or smoke from the vehicles that they'll actually come. So up until that point, it's just me. And you do the best that you can, unfortunately.
Now, Mark, just for folks playing the home game, RTC stands for what now?
Road traffic collision. It always used to be RTA, road traffic accident. But then the police came up with the thought that it's never just an accident. Someone's always at fault. Therefore, it's a road traffic collision now. That's the politically correct way to say it.
That's a great point. I think over here in the States, we have just recently, in the last couple of years, have mandated that on any federal highway, we have to use the high visibility vests, which are same color scheme as what you guys are using, the green and white checker and the bright yellow vests with those. Now, I respond here up on our highways with a paramedic vehicle, and it's just us. Unless there's an entrapment, it's just us and maybe a couple of police officers. But you know, we've got a three to four lane highway that we have to deal with. How do you deal with the safety of yourself on the highways?
Unfortunately, just as I said, you do the very best you can. I guess it's more about situational awareness and being constantly on your guard and constantly reassessing. And I think it's one of the things that you cannot be taught, and you only get there through experience and putting yourself in that situation and, unfortunately, a couple of close calls over the years, that you learn that, yes, your priority is the patient, but you're constantly looking at what's around you, who's there. And you mean you're also responsible for trying to keep an eye on everything else that's going on as well. You know, we've recently, in the last 2 years, we've had another agency come on board, the Highways Agency, for collisions on our motorways. And they turn up fairly quickly and they help control the scene itself. And they're excellent for getting people off the carriageway and onto safety. But for yourself, all I can really say is there's just that self-awareness. You know, you're constantly aware of what's around you. If there's traffic passing you either side, you obviously stay out of the way of that best you can and use your vehicle the best way you can. We always park in the fend-off position to create the most maximum barrier that we can to save any collisions coming into ourselves, and then just use what we have around us and use our own visibility and our own awareness.
Do you know off the top of your head roughly how many providers are struck and injured or killed over there?
Not off the top of my head. There have been some high-profile cases over the last year or so with motorway workers being killed and stuff. But as far as I'm aware, touch wood, a lot of wood. I'm touching it now. I don't know of any ambulance personnel that have been killed at the scene of an RTC through vehicle collisions. But then, you know, it always seems a lot worse over in the States, but then I keep reminding myself that my whole country can virtually fit into California. So, you know, you have a lot more opportunities to be hurt than we do in our little country here.
Do you think that's because of the drivers?
I wouldn't thought so. I'm sure it's the same the world over. As soon as there's a collision, the traffic slows down to crawling pace with everyone rubbernecking and trying to see what's going on anyway. And we do have, and not so rare occurrences. I'm sure it's the same over there, where you have secondary collisions further up the line of traffic with everyone just trying to see what's going on, and collisions on the opposite carriageway with people straining the necks, you know. So there is still that lack of regard. I've seen plenty policemen yelling abuse at cars that are passing who don't slow down. And actually, I was at an RTC 2 weeks ago where one of the policemen actually had to back out of the way rather quickly and jump out of the way of a car who was swerving because he was trying to see what was going on. So I don't think it's a UK driver thing that makes us apparently lucky. I just think a lot of it has to do with luck.
What safety equipment do you guys carry besides your vests and your gear? What other safety equipment do you guys carry in your vehicles?
Specifically in what regard? As in personal safety or...?
Personal safety, roadway safety. I mean, you don't carry cones or anything like that, do you?
No, nothing at all. We have nothing that we can put on the road or put on the carriageway to sort of ward off or to provide a route for traffic to pass us by. It's a case of it's our vehicle. And us, we all I have personal safety wise is my high vis jacket and my helmet, and obviously gloves and stuff if need be. But that's it.
How apt are the police over there to shut down a roadway or give you the extra time that you need on scene to deal with the accidents and the incidents that you guys have?
They're great. They're brilliant. We have a very good working relationship with the police, much better than we do with the fire brigade. We're working on our relationships with the fire brigade all the time. We do joint training now, and that's come along quite a way. But as far as the police goes, yes, you know, they'll always come over straight away and ask the severity of the incident because they need to know if they need to close the whole road, if it's likely to be a fatality or a serious injury. But other than that, once you let them know how serious it is or whatever, then you work together. If it's a minor injury, you know, I have no problem staying on scene to let them jump on the back of the ambulance and breathalyze and ask a few questions. But if it's serious, then they'll keep out of our way and just ask where we're taking the patient and they'll follow up. If it's fairly minor, they do sometimes come after a while and just say, look, lads, how long are you going to be? We would like to get the road open. But there's never any pressure for them. I find them to be an excellent resource and an excellent help on scene.
That's some really good points to think about. I mean, you know, here the police like to try to open up roadways, at least in our area, try to open up the roadways as fast as possible. I can't remember the actual numbers. I wish Tim was here. I believe it's for every 1 minute of delay, you've got 4 minutes of backup. And that's where you start to have your secondary collisions with that. So in terms of safety, what type of training do you receive in your programs regarding roadway safety and stuff, Mark?
Obviously, our training's changed in the last couple of years. We've gone from when I trained out, I was an IHCD paramedic, which was an internal course, 10-week training to be an advanced technician, then 2 years on the road, and then another 10 weeks to be a paramedic. With that training, it was covered in kinematics and the trauma section of that. It was briefly sort of mentioned. There wasn't any specific training specifically for safety wise. You know, when we went and did our basic trauma life support courses, then obviously we went through the body substance isolation review, scene safety, approach to scene triage, but that was an extra bit of training. A lot of what we did back in them days, which wasn't that long ago, seemed to be learning on the job and learning from your colleagues. Our training's now a 2-year foundation degree to become a paramedic, and I don't know the content of that course specifically with regards to road traffic collisions and scene safety and management, but I know it'll be covered probably more than what it was in my day.
Now, you had mentioned, when you show up on scene of an RTC, you see there's some damage to the car. You're going to get out. You're wearing your... What do you wear up to the car, typically?
Typically, I'll just wear depending on the weather, it's either a high visibility coat or a high visibility tabard if it's warm. And that's it. That's all I'll go out. And obviously, I'll have my kit bag and everything.
Why do you think we are so... Well, why do you think that we don't adopt those? I mean, when I look at a lot of photographs and a lot of images from the UK and from over there, you know, the high visibility gear, the proper helmets, proper eyewear, and this is just, these aren't even set up pictures. These are just general pictures at the scene. But whenever I see motor vehicle crashes here in the States, we see people in flip-flops, T-shirts, shorts, you know, and no helmets or stuff like this. Why do you feel that we've had a hard time adopting over here?
I don't know. I mean, obviously, it's different with you, but all I can think of is obviously fire-based response. I would assume they always turn up in all the fire gear and the bunker kit anyway. That's got some high visibility reflection on it. I honestly don't know, Kyle. It's I mean, it's a European standard now where everyone in the European Union, all the ambulance services have to conform to this bright yellow livery that we have. And it's just a standard. I guess there's some research somewhere that says that this is how it works. Why it hasn't been taken up in the US up until now. I mean, Justin, he was mentioning a little while ago on his blog that a couple of his new fire engines that were coming online have got the high-vis Hutchins on the back. And the change in the colours, and they're being made to wear their high visibility jackets now as well. Maybe it's just one of them things that, you know, for a change, just use her a little bit behind us and the European Union on that. You know, we always seem to trail medically a couple of years behind everything that you guys do. It's made, you know, safe, and it shows its worth in the States. Then it comes to us. Maybe this has just been the other way around. I don't really know.
Steve, being a emergency management up in Ontario, you see a lot of this. How do you guys address it?
Well, Kyle, we've adopted the standards, and I was just getting ready to type you a message here, but I wonder if it isn't an issue of private service versus municipal or government-funded service, where we're dealing with our paramedic service here in Ontario being entirely government employees, funded by the government and the taxpayers, as opposed to private services that are a little more concerned perhaps with profit margins.
That's something to look at. I mean, I'm now working in a municipal system, and I've got great equipment. Natalie, Scott, Jeremiah?
I was about to jump in and say that. I work for a private service, and we just got our high visibility vests for our Christmas bonus this year. So before that, we were operating without any of that.
Merry Christmas, don't get hit.
Yeah, Merry Christmas, I hope you don't die, basically.
I was going to comment about, I guess your comment about us having a slower response to the high visibility wear and the safety on scene. For as long as I've been in the field, which is about 4.5 years now, at least in Southern California, where I've been working, it's been part of our standard operating procedures that if you're standing in the road, you have a breast jacket and a helmet. And that's just the way we've always been trained. And the two major fire departments, LA County and LA City, any traffic response is always full turnout gear. For the private services that I've worked for, we call them breast jackets, but they're essentially Nomex on the outside and then a biohazard shield on the inside. And fire helmets that were provided to us, and I think given to us by the county, actually. Even though we were a private service, we still were very closely integrated with the municipal services and the county, and it was just, there wasn't really any sort of question about it. It's just, okay, well, you're going to be in the road, put this on. And interestingly enough, when I came out here to Louisiana, I brought gear with me, and Natalie's saying, well, why do you have that? I said, well, there's glass, and there's traffic, there's fire, and there's stuff. And she said, well, when do you put it on? I said, well, we get dressed at the station, and then we leave. And it just wasn't even a concept out here. It just wasn't even something that they had thought of. Oh, yeah, we should wear helmets. We should wear coats. But it's written in our policy manual, and even some of the supervisors would drive around, and if they would cite you, not wearing your proper safety gear, they'd pull you aside. You'd maybe get, a point on your record. It was enforced very seriously out there.
I mean, I can't tell you how many scenes I've worked as a young medic, and I'm the smallest person on scene, and the firefighters are really big, fat guys that really don't get a lot of training, and they say, well, you fit in that car, how about you go in, and I put on their turnout gear instead. But even then, it's just like, we don't have the gear here. It's not used. I'm listening to all of this stuff, and I suddenly feel, after meeting Jeremiah especially, I definitely feel like I need some of that in my life. Our ambulances don't even have high vis on the exterior. There's nothing but our lights.
It is changing, though. I believe the chevrons on the back are now a DOT standard, or it's going to be by a certain year. I can't quote the exact date or whatever, but more and more services are doing that. Acadian done it. LA County and LA City, every new vehicle that's on the road has those high-vis chevrons on the back.
Right.
So I would suspect that in the next 3 to 5 years, if services haven't just upgraded, it's going to become mandatory anyway.
Right.
Already with the high-visibility vest. So,
I think the other thing that we need to look at is in terms of equipment that we carry on the trucks. Now, Mark, I've seen pictures of UK ambulances, and they're very, I believe they're the Sprinters, aren't they?
Yeah, Mercedes Sprinters we're using at the moment with a WAS back on it, which is made in Germany.
And you guys got rid of the bench seats, or you guys never had a bench seat? How was that?
We used to have, when I first started, we had the American GMC Suburban trucks. One of our guys came over and purchased a load of those, and we were using those. We had Suburbans, and we had the, I can't remember the name of them, the stubby nose type. It's the type that I was riding on in San Francisco with Justin. And they had the bench seat. No, they didn't. They had two separate seats as well. We've never had the bench seats, but certainly what we've got now is individual seats, all with seat belts and such like. I was actually had a meeting at headquarters yesterday, and I was showing them a couple of clips. And every time I look at the clips from the Chronicles of VMS, when I see, you know, me and Justin in the back of the ambulance, just driving away from an RTC scene, and you know, Justin's on his honkers in the middle of the floor dealing with the patient, and I'm sort of holding onto the bench seat. And that would not happen here. You know, they're very, very strict about the back of the ambulances, which is why everything's hidden away behind sliding doors. You know, there's nothing which can come out. There's nothing which can act as a missile in the back of the ambulance. We're even not allowed to take any luggage with patients to the hospital officially, because that can't be strapped down and secure. And again, that's another European directive which we all have to abide by.
Yeah, I think that's what's something that we need to start looking at here. I know Dr. Nadine Levick does a lot of that discussions and research into those things. Things we need to start looking at is, we need to make it safer for us, is we need to look at our own safety. You know, a lot of times you hear the comments of the fire service, 100 years of tradition, unimpeded by progress with that. And that's one thing that you always kind of run into. So the next thing I want to kind of lead into is management. In the States, we should, if we roll up onto a scene of a motor vehicle crash, whether it be 3, 4, or 5 patients. Now, remember, in some areas around here, and, you know, Natalie, probably down where you are in some areas, I know some areas where I am here and folks, that 4 or 5 patients is going to strain your system, and it's going to be considered an emergency, a disaster, at least until everyone, you know, gets in there to mitigate the situation. But I think, you know, we come up on scene, and we're supposed to be establish a command structure and go from there. Now, the first person on scene is going to be taking a lot of the command. They'll be doing command. They may be doing triage. Maybe having another person doing safety. Now, Mark, do you guys run under a similar program as that, or is that just strictly over here in North America?
No, I mean, we have our MIMS course, the Major Incident Medical Management and Strategy course, and you know, that's obviously for the really big jobs. As far as if there was just 3 or 4 cars involved, there would hopefully be more than just one ambulance sent to that. There would probably be 2 or 3 sent. The first one on scene is expected to feedback to control as soon as possible about what services are actually required. Automatically, the fire brigade would come to that anyway, because it's a significant potential of a significant job, and the police would be coming as well. But as far as if I was first on scene, my job would be a quick triage of the scene, and then obviously we'll have our handheld radios straight through to control, and as I've scanned the scene, then I'll quickly make an assessment on roughly how many patients are likely to go, and then how many ambulances we'll need from that, and then I would request additional units as required. It's something that Justin mentioned again when he saw us, because we don't have the bench seats, because we have, you know, static captain's chairs all the way around, and then the one stretcher. All you need is, and I'm sure it's the same over there, sometimes you'll just have a slow impact speed where everyone's holding on to the necks and you can't clear the C-spine, and every patient has to go on a spinal board. And so with our ambulances, if someone has to go on the spinal board, it's one patient for that ambulance. So if you've got 4 people with neck pain, that's 4 ambulances coming. And that does stretch, you know, our service at times. And there are some times where you do have to wait for those resources to come to you. But I would imagine that the initial triage, the initial decisions about what's required is the same for us, it's just the same for you. Again, it's taught and it's expected that you know that.
Steve? I'm sorry, Scott, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to ask Mark, in addition to that, I mean, you know, we've heard all about, through Chronicles, the system that you run over there. Where does the triage fall at that point? I mean, if you pull into a scene with 4, 5, 6 ambulances, do you take the time to make the assessment and triage the people out who you would normally not send to the hospital? Or at that point, do you just kind of fall back on, all right, everybody's going, you know, with, or make the assumption at that point that everybody's going.
No, I certainly don't make the assumption that everyone's going out. As I'm going through it, it's literally a quick look. I'll quickly glance at the car, look at the mechanisms involved, the potential for injury. And then if people are up and out of the cars, take it for if I'm on the rapid response car and if I'm first on scene and it's just me in the car, then it's a case of I'll go through everyone. If anyone looks particularly unwell, obviously they're getting an ambulance anyway. But a lot of these multiple impacts that we have on our motorways are fairly slow speed fender benders or whatever. And it'll be a case of if they're up, are you all right? You know, do you have any neck pain? Do you have any back pain? And that's going to be my... That's all they're going to get at that point. And if they say, no, I'm fine, no, I'm fine, then I'll move on to the next one. And I'll assume that unless something changes, that they're not going to be going to hospital after I've done my full assessment later, after more hands are on scene to help me. You know, it's, I guess a lot of the times with the multiple cars, again, I'm assuming this is minor injury type stuff, my mindset is more of who doesn't need to go instead of who does need to go. You know, when unfortunately it's the same, it's still the same over here with the fact, even though we can leave people at home or refer on, you know, if they've got that central C-spine tenderness, they're going to hospital, even if there's no damage to the car. And even if you're pretty sure there's nothing going on. Other than that, then I'll be considering, do they really need to go, or do they need to go by ambulance, or can they make their own way up in the family car who's coming to pick them up or whatever?
No, I think that's kind of where it's a little different. You kind of actually make the decision who's going by what mode. Is that right, Mark?
Yes. And there's times where if I'm on scene and say if there's three patients and two have got neck pain and one's just minor injury, then I might call two ambulances down for the two. And then the third one, once the scene's cleared, they can just jump in the back of my car and I'll run them up to accident emergency if they don't have any transport themselves. Or there's also sometimes the police will help out, you know, if there's no need for them to go dashing up to hospital, if it's just cuts and bruises or anything like that, then they might do their investigations. And if they're going up to hospital to interview the other patients anyway who've had to go by ambulance, then I have known some of the police to say, it's all right, we'll just run them up when we're finished.
Now, are there a lot of lawsuits? I mean, I'm not familiar with the UK legal system, but are there a lot of lawsuits over there with these car accidents?
There's a lot of claims for neck pain. You know, we now have joined the culture of, you know, if you've had an accident, you can make a claim. And there's people certainly looking for claims as soon as there's been anything done to them. Lawsuits to the ambulance service, can't comment specifically on mine, but I'm not aware of any huge amounts of, well, there mustn't be, because if there was, then it would change the practice of what we do. You know, so either we're inherently safe in the way that we practice and within our guidelines and boundaries, or I'm assuming it just mustn't go wrong.
Steve, what about up in Canada there?
Well, unfortunately, we're starting to see a lot more litigation as well following collisions, and we're absolutely starting to see more claims against municipalities and practitioners following collisions. And again, it comes down to that neck pain. It really is becoming more and more of a concern for us as we become a more litigious society.
You stole my word. I love that. It's one of my favorite. Litigious is one of my favorite words there.
I think I probably got that from one of your seminars, actually. So, yeah, I don't know.
So, basically, Mark, you don't see a lot of litigation versus the rescue, then, the medical side.
No. I mean, I was part of... up until recently, things have changed, but there was a clinical review panel which I used to sit on for when complaints came in, and I did spend a year in headquarters working at a couple of years ago, and I was part of the review panel of every complaint that came in, and I don't know of any that ended up in compensations, payouts, or anything like that, because it was usually sorted out well before then, and it sort of tended to go more down the lines of, you know, misunderstandings or poor communication rather than, you know, neglect or anything like that. When we were introduced to this concept of respond, not convey, you know, going to the patient, assessing them and advising them that they don't need to go to hospital on this occasion, you know, a lot of people were very hesitant about that. And so it hasn't been a case of everyone jumping in because we've got the ability to do this. It's more of a case of people are aware of how open it makes them. You know, and as soon as you advise a patient that they don't need to attend hospital, then you are leaving yourself open if something goes wrong, that we are inherently safe in what we do. You know, if there's any risk or if there's any doubt in your mind, then you default to go to hospital.
So basically this is something that's kind of new then?
When did I do mine? 5 years. I'd say probably about 5 years now we've been doing this.
What do you guys think? I mean, you know, the rest of the panel here, what do you guys think about that idea? Anybody?
Oh, no, I was just going to come in there. You know, in the United States, we can't really ever, well, of course, no one can ever refuse transport or treatment. And I'm not someone who necessarily advises people against seeking treatment. But what I do is I put it in their hands. I leave it to their own choice. I've seen a lot of other providers, they just get in the habit of, they do their assessment, they package up, and they just start whisking people away. Because, yeah, that's it. I showed up, and you're going to go. And I like to do an assessment, and then I like to tell the patient what I found. Here's your vital signs. Here's your injuries. Here's everything that I see, reminding them that I can't tell you what's best for you, or, you know, I don't know everything that's going on. But then basically just say what I can see here in my limited scope and skill is showing up normal. What would you like to do? And usually when you put it in their hands, I've noticed a lot of people say, well, no, I'm fine. And I'm never saying you're fine. I'm just saying what I see here is normal. And it's your choice of how you want to handle your care, which ultimately, you know, it is their own choice. But when you verbalize that to them and you really make it clear, this is because of you. You don't have to go because I'm here. You don't have to go because you're feeling pain. And they're presented with all the information. I notice a lot of people tend to choose not to go. And then you can also document that on your paperwork, not necessarily as a refusal, but just, you know, it was offered. And it was very clearly offered. It wasn't just this assumed care that they were going to get or this assumed transport. Can I go on?
Sorry, Jeremy. Do you follow that up with, there could be some underlying injuries that I don't see?
Yeah, well, when they say, I don't want to go, then we go down the regular spiel of if it was regular AMA, you know.
You do understand that this can, you know, yeah, you get that whole little speech.
But you leave it up to them as their choice. Now, it also depends on who's in command of the scene. It sounds like in Mark's system, first one there is incident commander for the entire event. In my system, which was pretty much fire-based, you know, we had a system of ranks. So once an engine captain showed up, they were incident commander. If a battalion chief showed up, then they were incident commander. And it ultimately fell on them who was going to go, who was not, what mode of transport, and the individual provider making decisions sort of went to the back burner.
I think with us, I'm a team leader, but if I'm there first, then I guess ultimately I'm responsible for the scene if I'm the only team leader there, if I'm the most senior member of staff. But what tends to happen is if there's more than one or two vehicles, then, you know, as the first vehicle comes in, I'll say, you know, this is this patient, this car, that car. And it'll just be, right, I've got this one. Do you want to take that one? And then the next vehicle can take that car. And once you've sort of delegated a smaller area of that incident, then they're responsible for what they do with that car. You know, they've got the same clinical training as me and they've got the same abilities as me as long as it's a paramedic crew. Therefore, if I pass on a car with occupants to that crew, then later on, as if I'm leaving scene or whatever, I might say, you know, what's happening with that crew? And then they'll say, oh, they're okay, they're not going, because they've assessed that patient and it's their responsibility what happens with them then. You know, so it's sort of delegated out. Obviously, it's a completely different matter if it's a true major incident. That's when the whole command structure comes in and the bronze commanders come in and take over everything. But as far as just a standard, you know, multiple vehicle RTC, then, you know, once a paramedic's got a car or got a patient, it's up to them what happens with that patient.
Mark, do you guys use the color coding for triage?
The what, sorry?
The color coding, green, yellow, red, black.
We would if it was a major incident.
Okay. So you don't use it on smaller incidents?
No. We have the slap bracelets, you know, the different colored slap bracelets, but they would only be used for a major incident.
All right. How do you, and if you've got like four or five cars, you may have anywhere between, you know, 4 to 10 patients, you know, there. How do you relay, especially after you're first on scene, how do you relay to the other incoming crews who's priority? Or do they have to re-triage and reassess the patients?
Well, once I've done the initial sweep and I know roughly which patient needs to go first or whatever, if it was a case of that and multiple ambulances coming, then I would take the step back and I would be looking after it. And as the first ambulance came in, I'd say, right, I want you to take this one, you know, and let them sort them. By this time, we'll have fire and police there, and I might well delegate, ask a couple of firemen if they're not busy to keep an eye on that car and that patient until the other ambulance comes in. Then as the other ambulance arrives, then I'd say, right, I need you to go to this car and look after this one. And if that was the case, then I would take a more central role in organising as it came in. But it's really not very often that happens here. You know, I can count on one hand in 10 years how many times we've had an incident with that sort of, you know, organization needed.
Now, in the States and, you know, Canada, is similarly, we've got a series of trauma centers, and, you know, based on mechanism of injury and physical findings and such, certain patients are triaged to trauma centers. Do you guys have a similar system in the UK?
We don't have trauma centers as such. We all know our local hospitals and what their capabilities are. We have my area, my actual station is in between Gateshead and Newcastle. Therefore, I have a main hospital in Gateshead and main hospital in Newcastle, which both have accident emergency facilities. The only thing where I would default out of my own area to go over to Newcastle is for head injuries, because that's the neuro center. Everything else is handled by both hospitals. Yeah, they both have trauma services. They both have on-call trauma teams and such like. And that would just be, that's the closest hospital, let's go there. The only way I would go to a different hospital is for head injuries, really.
Is that common in most of the facilities over there that they have a trauma service there?
In the major hospitals, yes. There has been cases where, I mean, there is another three hospitals in our area that have been downgraded where they don't have full accident and emergency services anymore. They just have walk-in centres or nurse-led services. There's one which does have doctors and does have an A&E service, but the rest of the facilities in the hospital don't lend themselves to you wouldn't want to be taken there if you were critically ill. So even if you were up towards that way, then you would come back around to the more appropriate hospital. We do have facilities where we can bypass hospitals if it's the most appropriate care and disposition care pathway for that patient.
What about the air medical? How often do you guys use air medical over there?
Very rarely in our area, because we're a very sort of urban area. The outlying Northumberland areas and the more rural areas do use it, but we only have access to two helicopters. It's a charity that runs at the Great North Air Ambulance, and we have one sort of in the north of our patch and one in the south. And they do a lot of work in the rural areas, but specifically in the city centres or in our areas, not so much, because we're only looking at a 10-minute transport time a lot of the times, and at the most it would probably be 20 minutes, and you would have to wait longer than that for them to actually arrive on scene.
Now, are you guys, in the States, we're seeing helicopters just multiply like rabbits over here. Is it being relatively steady over there, or are you guys starting to see increased helicopters?
It seems to be steady. Every ambulance service, we have 12 ambulance service trusts in the country. It's separated up into 12 different services, and every service now, I believe, has at least one helicopter to respond. A couple of them have two. I think one has three. But that's, I guess it's because it's not a profit thing. It's a charity. All the air ambulances are based on charity and donations and fundraising. Therefore, it can never just boom into anything more than what it is. And I don't really think there's a need for it too much over here either.
Why is that?
I don't know. It never seems to be. I mean, obviously, I guess I can only talk about what I'm used to. And even when where our class is rural with a long run in of half an hour, you know, even then you think about what's the benefit of actually bringing the helicopter in. Because there's so few and far between, you sort of think twice about, do I really need to call them? Because they may well be needed somewhere else, somewhere more rural, you know, some big RTC on some country road somewhere out in the sticks where they are actually really needed for transport times to get someone to hospital when it's needed.
Mark, I have a question about your helicopter response. I know in London they bring a trauma surgeon on scene in their helicopter. Is that not a resource in the services in the north of England where you are?
Yes, we both of our helicopters normally have a doctor and a paramedic on, an A&E doctor and a paramedic. One of them sometimes runs with two paramedics. And again, yeah, if you needed that facility, then you know you would think about calling them. But again, maybe I'm just lucky, but it's been a long time since I felt that there would be a need to have a doctor on scene for the care of that patient to be any better than what it would take just to get us out and get him to the hospital. It's the whole stay and play, load and go thing. You know, I've always been an advocate of, you know, minimal interventions on scene and let's just get them on the way to the hospital, you know. If someone's critically ill, you don't need to be staying around, hanging around waiting for someone else to come on scene unless it's absolutely necessary. Some of the other areas have the use of basic doctors. Which doesn't mean the basics. It's actually, again, a charitable organisation where doctors who've had advanced training in pre-hospital life support attend to scenes to help the ambulance service when needed. We don't have them in our area. I wish we did, because I think that would be a great response, that, you know, someone's on the way to you to assist if need be, without delaying stuff on scene. There's a blogger, I forgot, Rapid Response Doc, who's a basics doctor in London, and he provides a fantastic service, and it would be great to have him or someone like that in our service.
Now, what about your dispatch system? Because, you know, like Kyle was saying, there's more than enough helicopters in the United States. But what I fail to see in the dispatch of a helicopter is really adding up the time of getting the crew ready, taking off, responding, landing, setting up, you know, getting the patient on board, and in theory, when they do get in the air, they're gonna save 20-30 minutes in the air. But there's that 20-30 minutes that it takes for them to even get to scene. Are there systems in place where if a call comes in a rural area and you know it's 45 minutes to a hospital, that there's some sort of protocol where they automatically dispatch a helicopter where it may arrive on scene at the same time as the ground ambulance or shortly thereafter, and we don't have to, you know, add all this additional time of getting the helicopter ready, responding, landing, and so that time saving is actually obtainable.
Mm-hmm. As far as I'm aware, because I don't know the specific control protocols, but I know that if there's a significant risk of serious injury, then sometimes we'll get a message as we're traveling on scene saying that the air ambulance is being dispatched. I know a lot of the cases in the more rural areas, and bearing in mind when I say rural, it's like rural UK, it's not like rural USA where you've got really significant traveling times. You know, I guess some of our more rural places might have an hour's transport at max to get to a definitive care. And in that case, that's when the air ambulance is used and that's where the air ambulance is dispatched. I know there was some discussion a while ago when I was in headquarters. I was discussing some things with the air ambulance people, and I don't know if it's happened yet, but there was some talk about them getting access to our main command systems and the calls coming in so that they could actually self-dispatch if they felt they could be of use to a scene as well. I don't know if that ever happened, but there's certainly there's the request that can come from the crew. A lot of the times control will automatically send it if they feel it's going to be of a benefit, and then they can always stand it down if need be. And then there's also them self-dispatching if need be. But I guess there's also, because it's a charity, then you also have to think of the cost of the flights, and you know, every time it takes off, it costs a certain amount of money, so it has to be used appropriately. It can't just be used here, there, and everywhere just in case. And as far as I'm aware, I mean, our air ambulance services in the UK have got a fantastic reputation with the public, quite rightly so, because they help pay for it. But the work that they do is very often very significant because they're kept for the jobs that they're really needed for. And again, touch a lot of wood, I'm touching now, there's been no significant air ambulance incidents recently either. In the last many years I can remember, there hasn't been any ambulance crashes.
I probably almost assume that because, you know, being charity run, they're not profit driven. I think you're starting to see a lot. Even the nonprofits over here still have to run on a profit, and it is very expensive to fly for that. So we move on in terms of that. Is there going to be any difference in care given by you, Mark, than what you saw here when you were with Justin in terms of trauma care?
Not as far as, hold on, what did I see? What do I know about you guys? certainly, well, cardiac stuff, yes, I would say use a, well, certainly, I can only talk about San Francisco Fire Department because that's all I know, but they were more advanced with us with cardiac care. Trauma care, I don't think so much. I mean, I can, what can I do? I don't think there's anything that they could do that I can't do. I'm not sure because I don't know exactly what you can do.
Oh, I guess we, you know, all different aspects, anywhere from advanced airway management, facilitate innovations, to chest tubes.
Actually, let's readjust what I was going to say because I've just thought of some things. We can't RSI. We can't sedate someone to intubate them. We can't selectively intubate patients. We certainly can't do chest tubes. We can decompress a chest. We can use our ET tubes and LMAs and such like IV fluid therapy, IO. We all paramedics are trained in intraosseous infusion. But certainly I wouldn't be sticking any chest tubes in anybody. There is talk about a program coming for advanced practitioners in adult intensive care where they would be trained for transport of, like, inter-hospital transports and chest tubes and things like that. Whether that ever filters through, I don't know. But what is apparent is, as I said before, we're always a few years behind you guys. So a lot of the times, if yous are doing it, then it'll come over here eventually.
Well, it's interesting because you've probably seen and heard some of the debates we've had about airway management and intubation over here on that. And I don't know if not doing RSI, not doing facilitated intubation is such a bad thing.
Mm-hmm. That discussion is over here at the moment as well. There's been talk for a good couple of years of us losing the skill of intubation. I heard recently that one of the services down south has stopped training their student paramedics in intubation, but I don't know if that's correct or not. It was just heard on a couple of blogs. Personally, it has a use, but it's not the be-all and end-all for me. I'm not a huge intubation advocate. I don't think we should lose it, but if we do, then there's reasons behind it. I've recently been trialing the iGel laryngeal mask, and that's now come into our service, and I think personally, I love that device. It has its limitations, but I've found it to be a fantastic aid and a lot quicker than intratracheal intubation. I'm sure I would just expect that we'll keep it, but there's always that risk that, you know, the powers that be deem that we don't need to be able to intubate. But intubation doesn't make me a paramedic.
You know, it's really kind of funny to listen to, Mark, what you say about the care that we provide over here coming over there. And it really seems to be flip-flop to me listening to the stuff that you talk about, the safety measures and you know, the high visibility stuff that you guys do over there that's really just starting to kind of seep into the systems over here. It's kind of completely contrasted, you know what I mean? It's like we're doing more of the patient care, but you're doing more of the provider safety stuff.
Mm-hmm. And it's what we talked about on the Chronicles was that, you know, there's a lot I've seen that you can do in America, like CPAP on an ambulance. I'm dying to get that over here. I'm just about to start a 3-year master's degree in clinical research, and I've already got my thesis. If it's not in by then, I want to try and bring CPAP over. And, you know, yous have these interventions that I can see a real benefit for that we don't. But then the flip side, like you said, is that, you know, we have this ability to assess and refer patients on, which you don't, you know. And wouldn't it be great if we could meet somewhere in the middle and just be able to do everything? Would that not make us a great practitioner? I don't know, but, you know, there's so much we can learn from both sides of the Atlantic and try and implement things in each other's countries that would make us a far more efficient provider.
I kind of thought that was the point of Chronicles when I first heard about it, was to take the best out of every system and kind of, you know, unify in that emerging, you know, we all do the same job. Why can't we just take the best of everything, you know?
My ultimate goal with the Chronicles, which if it ever happens, who knows, but, you know, we always had this vision of, you know, traveling the world, picking the very best out of what everybody can do, and then seeing at the end of it, you know, what would the ultimate EMS provider be like? If there was such a thing possible, which it never could be, because we've all got limitations on what we can do based on funding and geography and such like and support services. But, you know, the more I get involved in the social media world, the more I get to know people like you guys. It's such a learning environment, you know, and it's just taking that final step to, instead of us just talking about it, how do we actually make the step to improve things in our own services and in other services?
Now, Mark, do you guys... Over here, we have a lot of volunteers, especially in some of the rural areas that can afford to have career staffing. Your EMS, your fire brigades, are they career? They volunteer? Do you have a mixture? How's it run?
We have a mixture. It's mostly career, fully paid firefighters. Some of the rural areas, more rural areas, have retained fire stations where they have firemen within that area who have other jobs but who can be released if a fire call comes in. They've got to live within 5 minutes of the station, and they're paid when they actually attend and when they do the calls. There are, again, it's the same thing. I think it's the brownouts you call them over there, is it, where some of the quieter stations, even if they're fully manned, are starting to lose engines on a night time and such like. You know, that's being discussed over here as well. Everywhere's cost cutting and everywhere's service efficiency at the moment. So whether that'll change to have more retained firemen if need be, I don't know. But at the minute, the fire brigade, certainly in my area, it's almost fully paid career firefighters.
What is the average? I mean, you're going to give it to me in pounds probably. What's the average starting pay for a paramedic in the UK?
For a paramedic, and I know this is going to really upset a lot of student paramedics or training EMTs over there, but if you if you get a place to be a student paramedic in the UK on a foundation degree course, as you start training, I think including the enhanced hours that you get for the out-of-hours payments, it works out about £16,000 to £17,000. So that's, what, about $25,000 as a student for the 2 years. And then once you qualify, then it goes up incrementally from there.
I know that's a big thing over here, especially with the privates versus the municipalities. Municipalities generally pay better than what the privates do. And hospitals are kind of in between that as well, because it is. We're running into issues with funding.
But is it still a case of, if you want to be, is there anywhere in the, I might be really naive here, but is there anywhere in the US that if you want to be a paramedic or an EMT that you actually get paid to train? Or is it all self-funded? You have to pay to get the training and then try and get a job?
There's a course here in Louisiana that Acadian puts on that pays the paramedics. You have to sign a 2-year contract. You sign a 2-year contract with the company, but they pay for your schooling and they pay for your clinicals and they pay for your school.
They don't pay you during class, though.
Yeah, they do.
Going to class is your job.
Going to class is your job.
Yeah.
Rural Metro does here in Buffalo with their EMTs.
Right.
And that's actually how they bring people in.
Yeah. You've got to make it, you know, you've got to make it attractive to people to actually want to do the job.
But then we can also put out the argument is, you know, are you getting high quality people versus folks that'll go ahead and spend the money to get their, you know, their education? When I went to school for photography and graphic design, no one paid me to go to school. I had to pay for that and then work on it, you know, after graduation.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I can tell by teaching some of these other courses that the quality of people is not always the best that are brought in these courses.
But then that goes both ways, because if you're not paying people to train, then there might be some people out there who could make fantastic paramedics but could never just afford to do it. You know, so it swings around about both ways. If you give people the financial incentive to do it, you could be attracting people who will make fantastic providers who could never have done that if they had to try and fund it themselves.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest issues that comes down to here in the States is a lot of places that, especially in terms of paramedic, well, definitely EMT, it's not a college course. It's just usually a certificate program, and the ability to get financial aid, financial funding and grants is very limited for those type of programs. Once you become a degree program, then the door is open to get Pell grants and other various state and federal grants for education.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that may be one thing that they should, you know, we should look at is, you know, making it, you know, a degree program nationally for even EMT, and that may then get us into some funding for that. So, well, anyone have any other questions for Mark?
I'll just say one last thing, which I was wanting to try and bring up. I was involved a couple of years ago in something which took nearly 3 years to do, and it finally got ratified and got put out about a year and a half ago. Hasn't made a great deal of difference to the everyday things that we do, but I thought it was interesting. I'm wondering if any of you have done anything like that as well. And that's, we had a joint road traffic collision protocol, which was a fairly large document, which was agreed by all the services, the fire, police, ambulance and the highways agency, which laid out in very plain detail exactly what everybody's responsibility was at the scene of an RTC. You know, who was responsible for patient safety, who was responsible for scene management, who was responsible for protecting evidence and such like. And honestly, the amount of times, the amount of revisions that there were before everyone could actually agree on this is what we are going to work by and this is what we're going to be judged by about how our roles are affected at the scene of an incident. It was a huge undertaking, but it finally got done. It finally got put out there. Again, I haven't really seen it publicly available to every member of staff, and I'm sure there's a significant amount of staff don't even know it exists, but to be involved in it was a very interesting process, and I was sort of quite proud of what came out of it at the end. But has that ever been done, or do you have anything like that over in your areas?
Not federally. I know they probably have talked about stuff. The problem is all the branches want to run things their own way. Police want to run it one way. Fire wants to run it another way. EMS wants to do it another way. And that's the one thing I think that you run into over here.
And I think that's what drove this one, was that, you know, there was times where you saw arguments occurring on scene. You know, the police are obviously... They had this running joke where they called the fire brigade the evidence destroyers. You know, here come the evidence destroyers driving through the center of the scene. You know, and the fire brigade have names for the police and for us. And it got to the point where this was needed, where it was right, let's set out exactly who does what and why. You know, obviously open to changes as the scene progresses, but it was good to have that understanding of exactly what every service is responsible for and the reasons behind why they maybe get so vocal about what they're trying to do.
And we need something like that. We've actually had firefighters, fire chiefs, and paramedics arrested by law enforcement on scene because of arguments such as that. And if you look in the literature, various trade magazines and websites, you do a search on that, you'll find them. They've occurred, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually one of the purposes of First Few Moments, is to start looking at all those various aspects of you know, responsibilities and who we need on scene. It's, you know, the purpose of the podcast is to open up to discussion of these things, you know, law and everything from law enforcement to firefighting, and the actual program of First Few Moments is everyone asks, well, is it for firefighters or EMTs, paramedics? I'm like, it's for everybody, because everybody has to have an understanding of what everyone else does and what everyone else's roles and responsibilities are. You know, and when it comes into, you know, crash investigation, those are very important things you have to find out. You know, who is at fault? Is there going to be charges? Is there not going to be charges for that? When it comes into extrication, who are you going to take out and when? And when do we stop extrication to do care? And why are we doing that care? And that's really the whole premise behind the First Few Moments program, is to start, you know, discussing these things and talking about these things. So when we have these small, you know, even these small MCIs of 3, 4, 5, 6 patients, they run smoother. And we are able to mitigate the situation.
You know, that would make a great podcast, you know, just to get, you know, a paramedic on, a fire officer on, specifically for fire duties, not for the paramedic side, and a police officer, a motor police officer or something on, and just let it go. See what happens, let the arguments fly. That would be really interesting.
I think you gave me my next version of my next podcast here in a couple of weeks on that, Mark. I got to thank you for that one. That's a great idea.
I'll suggest a certain police blogger that would be very good to have on for that one.
Oh, please do. Yeah, you'll have to send me his name on email.
Yeah.
I'd appreciate that.
Yeah.
All right. Does anyone else have any other questions? We're coming on about an hour now. If not, Mark, I want to say thank you so much for joining us. And before we get to your information, I have to say Mr. Steve Murphy had a situation arise up there in Dauphin County. He had to go run. He's actually the emergency manager for a county, so I'm just interested to see what they got going on up there. But for him, you can get a hold of him at stevemurphy@firstfewmoments.com. And next we have the Ms. Paramedic, Natalie Quibdo. How can we get a hold of you?
Oh, you can just Google Ms. Paramedic, and I promise you'll find me. But easiest way is... MissParamedic@gmail.com. Also, I'm on Twitter @MissParamedic. So I'm easily accessed.
Thank you, Natalie. Jeremiah?
Well, like Natalie said, just go to Google or your preferred search engine and type in Jeremedic, and I would hope I'm the only thing that shows up. But Jeremedic1@gmail or the blog, Jeremedic.com, or @Jeremedic on Twitter.
MutualAidTV@gmail.
Yep, the Mutual Aid Project. You can check that out. youtube.com/mutualaid, or send us the email, mutualaidtv@gmail. We're around, you know.
We're all over. You can't escape us.
Great, guys. Thank you so much for joining us. Scott, how can we find you?
You can find me on Twitter at MedicSBK. My email is MedicSBK@gmail.com. And check out my blog, 2010EMS.blogspot.com. I've got a lot of stuff going on from the social media aspect over the last couple of weeks. It's kind of interesting to me.
That'll be great. Yeah, so get on there and definitely check that out. And then all the way from the UK, Mr. Mark Glencourse, thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to talk with us. I appreciate that. And where can we find you?
First of all, thank you. It's been nice to do it at not 3 o'clock in the morning, so thanks for that. my email is mglencourse@yahoo.co.uk. You can find me on Twitter at UKMedic999. My blog, which has been down for a little while, well, it's still there, but I haven't been posting on it, is 999medic.com. But keep an eye on that over the next few days for a bit of an announcement.
Great. We're looking forward to that. I'm getting excited. I've been following the Twitters on those. So, and you can find me, KyleDavidBates.com, on Twitter, @ImageMedic. You can also follow First Few Moments at First Few Moments on Twitter and FirstFewMoments.com as well. We'd also like to hear your comments. Go ahead and give us a call at 716-245-5336. That's 5FFM. And we'll go ahead and throw those at the end of a podcast when we get some. But I want to thank everybody. I want to thank my panel, especially thank Mark for joining us on that. Again, I'm glad it's not 3 o'clock in the morning. I think we'll have a few more of these. This is actually a good time for us as well. So for Mark, Scott, Steve, Natalie, and Jeremiah, have a good day and be safe out there.